for the week of November 10th, 2013. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 213, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gills.
Well, Michael,
I was going to say I was in Valhalla or whatever, but I forget where Thor lives. I forget where his, you know, home base is, so I couldn't say it.
Doesn't he jump between time?
Well, he's not a time traveler as such, as far as I know, but he's, you know, he's a god, a demigod or a god. He's the god of thunder.
I've never really
been in Norse mythology, which is some of my favorite mythology, but I forget where Thor's home base is.
Well, we don't want you to forget where you can subscribe to our show. You can do that on iTunes or Stitcher or any place they aggregate and give away podcasts for free. So wherever you download podcasts, more than likely, we can be found there. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter. At Showbiz Sandbox is our handle there. We have a Facebook page where you can like us. Showbiz Sandbox, if you just search for it, that's where you'll find us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. So if you have any comments about what we talk about on today's show, feel free to email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com, again, is the email address. And we even have a phone number, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Now that we got the preliminaries out of the way, Michael, should we talk about what's going to be on today's show?
Absolutely.
Because we're going to talk about Thor, which is a huge success, though not in 3D, as we'll point out. In fact, dissecting...
Die, 3D, die!
Well, if we dissect the box office returns for Thor, it reveals quite a few interesting tidbits. And you just know how much we love to dissect box office grosses. We've talked about how DVR viewing has boosted ratings for popular shows in the past, and now the head of CBS wants advertisers to pay for that increased viewership for all those watching and time-shifting shows for up to 7 days later. We'll explain because this could be a huge, huge news for broadcasters. We'll also tell you about some big fish on Broadway. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilts to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie around the world is Thor, The Dark World. For the second week in a row, it's number one. It grossed $180 million worldwide. Of course, it opened in North America to about $86 million, a big success. So far, it has taken in $327 million worldwide. It's already pretty much matched its overseas gross for the first Thor film. That means the first Thor film grossed about, I think, $260 million when all was said and done. It's already grossed $240 million internationally. So this movie is off to a tremendous start. It looks like it could double practically what the first Thor film made. That's probably a little high of a goal, but it's certainly going to make, it could be $600 million, you know, $700. We'll have to see what the legs are like, but it's off to a great, great start.
So that's kind of what's happening with these big, giant blockbuster sequels now. They might start off at $300 million, the first go-around, but then people watch it on DVD or VOD or streaming on Netflix, and then they race out to see the movie, the second movie.
Well, I don't know if we've ever seen anything like these Marvel movies and how they've set them up and how they've done them. This is why Disney is so amped up about doing it with Star Wars as well. But it's having a crazy effect. In the old days, you'd make a movie. If it was a hit, you made a sequel. And if you were lucky, it made about 2/3 of what the original made.
Right.
And then the sequel after that cost more, made even less. That's how it happened. Then you'd see little boosts from like VHS and DVD. Die Hard, a good solid success, but Die Hard 2 was a huge success because everybody saw it on VHS or DVD, whatever the format was. So the rules sort of changed there. Now we have a lot of movies that tell one long story, like Harry Potter or the Twilight films. If whatever that first or second movie makes, that's what all the movies in the series make. There's no up and down. Once you've locked in your audience, you know what you're going to get till the film is over, unless, you know, some disaster strikes. But we saw how consistent the Harry Potter films were, how consistent the Twilight movies were. And, you know, it's just a... That's a new phenomenon, I think.
But really, there were serials in the
1940s. Yeah, you had dependable little movies, but as far as big blockbuster films, you know, it just wasn't this is, I think, unheard of to make 7 films in a row, all of them getting extraordinarily consistent box office. Now with Marvel, this is, I mean, you don't even know what to think. I mean, you launch the series with Iron Man, and then you put these other movies out, Captain America, Thor, and then you have the big movie, The Avengers. And that sort of has accelerated all the other movies. Iron Man, the last Iron Man, was huge. And now we have Thor taking off. Who knows what will happen with Captain America? These movies are acting like sequels to The Avengers rather than sequels to their original film. So they led up to this big movie, The Avengers. And now these spinoffs seem more like sequels to that 1.5 billion monster that was The Avengers, which is why Thor has such a much bigger audience now. It's doing so much better. It could easily, you know, increase by 50, 60, 70% what the first one made worldwide. So it's all the rules seem thrown out the window. It's kind of weird and exciting.
Well, you know, if you were to ask Anita Elbers, the author of Blockbusters, who we're going to have on next week's show, she wrote this book that kind of reviews all of this and talks about exactly what we're talking about here, which is, hey, these, you know, it's a surefire bet when you release a big giant movie on a wide platform.
Well, she says basically that the smartest bets big corporations can make are blockbuster bets.
Right.
You've got to go for the tentpole movies. You've got to go for the big splashy TV series. You've got to go for the big book with the big advance that you put in 1,000 stores. You have to make those big bets because that's where all the money is going to be made. You're not always going to succeed, but the smart money is to make those big bets, not to do something like, you know, take your $200 million for the Avengers and make 100 movies that cost $2 million and hope one of them click. That's
right.
Not the way to go. So I'm looking forward to talking to her. But for Thor 3D, of course, is in 3D. I didn't care. Nobody else seemed to care. This was a remarkable rejection of 3D, I thought.
Well, you know, in a way, I think the industry and Disney especially would say, actually, this is exactly where we thought 3D was headed.
Oh, please.
We thought it was...
They thought, hey, both don't have any retrospective politeness to them. They thought every movie was going to be in 3D. They thought everything, comedy, drama, action, big tempo movies were all going to be in 3D, and they make most of their money from 3D, and everybody would flock to the movies because they could only see them in 3D. People are running in the opposite direction from 3D. They hate 3D. The only reason probably half the tickets were sold in 3D is because they had no choice. This movie was on 3,100 3D screens. It was only on 700 screens in 2D. 700. And it made like 65% of their ticket sales on those 700 screens. So they had 1/4 of the screens, but they sold 65% of the tickets. They made 50, how many millions of dollars? They made $51 million in 2D. So that means they made $35 million in 3D, 3D IMAX, and all the other large formats. I'm sorry, you put a movie on 3,100 screens in 3D, and you make far less than you did off the 700 screens in 2D. That's not what they expected. They did not say that. They did not expect. They're not spending all that money to have people flock to 2D, because that's what people did.
Well, I do believe that Jeffrey Katzenberg was the only person in Hollywood that thought every movie would be shot in 3D. However, I think
this is a rejection. It's falling low. Come on. This is one of the big movies of the year. It opening weekend was 40% 3D. That means it's going to fall in the days and weeks to come because nobody's walking out saying, oh, my God, you have to see the 3D in this movie. This
well,
isn't
it's
gonna gravity.
Fall if only because, you know, they need those 3D screens for other films that are
it's going
to
fall because people don't want to see it in 3D. And the people who do go opening weekend, the casual fan who might see Thor because it's a big hit, does not want to pay extra money for 3D. It's not like Gravity. Gravity is one of those movies that you're going to have 3 or 4 times a year, like The Hobbit or the next Avatar, where people say, I hear it's got 3D. I hear the 3D's cool. I want to see it in 3D. And that's what happened with Gravity. And that can happen 3 or 4 times a year. But family films and big movies like this are not automatic 3D movies. And most people do not want to pay extra to see it that way. They're making it clear. Now, when it comes down to 30%, you're going to say, well, Hollywood always expected only 30% of the...
I think it's headed more towards 30, actually, is where most smart...
I think it's headed to them stopping to make every movie in 3D. And every animated film is in 3D. Every big tempo movie is in 3D. They threw this thing on IMAX at the last minute. Anybody, why would you pay $20 to see this movie in IMAX? It's ridiculous.
Well, I saw Gravity in IMAX. It was fantastic.
That they carefully created. It wasn't shot in IMAX, but at least they carefully designed it to be shown in IMAX.
That's right.
And the 3D, they put a lot of effort into it. And people, not me, thought the 3D was exceptional and worth the time. Clearly, audience responded to that, just like they will to The Hobbit. But Thor was thrown onto IMAX screens at the last minute. 2 weeks before it opened, they said, let's put it on IMAX because it did so well overseas.
Well, I know that with Gravity, its 3D take is, I guess, what, up to like 79%, right?
Yeah, it's almost, yeah, a ton. It's one of those movies they want to see in 3D. That's going to happen. It'll happen with Avatar, happen with The Hobbit. There are certain movies a couple times a year that they make in 3D, make it well, make it carefully, and people respond to that. But when every movie's in 3D, they're not going to bother. Thor didn't need to be in 3D. We don't need to see the hammer coming at us. And I think the audience is making that clear. You cannot tell me Hollywood said, oh, this is what we expected all along. No, it's not.
Well, I think, let's put it this way. The smart
people.
Well,
why are they open on 3,100 screens in 3D and they're only getting 40% of their gross from 3,100 screens? Why is it on 3,100 screens? They made most of their money off 2D. Why aren't they opening on more 2D screens?
Now, that's a good question. That is a question that I think over time will wind up. I think right now the exhibitors want to try and earn back that money for that 3D equipment, which they themselves had to pay for. There's no virtual print fee for those. For that 3D equipment, so they want to try and pay for that because they get a huge chunk of that.
But don't they want seats? They want seats in the theater.
That's right. They need
and they're making it hard for people to see the movie the way they want. And guess what? When it's down to 1,000 screens in 3D and 2,000 or 3,000 screens in 2D, guess what? The 3D sales will drop a lot lower because there won't be all those viewing times and people won't be forced to go to it. Well, and you know what? The people who saw it in 2D had more fun because those 700 screens were a lot fuller than the 3,100 half-empty 3D screens, because that's exactly what they were.
I want you to bring that up with our guest next week, because she's
not going to know about screen exhibitor things and like that.
No, she actually, in the book, talks about how...
I've read the whole book.
Okay, just... All right, well...
You haven't even finished it.
I haven't finished it yet. I'm going to finish it before...
I read it.
All right. Well, you know, we were just talking about Gravity, and Gravity is the number two film around the world this week. It's still chugging along.
Not chugging along, it's making money hand over fist. Another $34 million. It's at $472 million worldwide and counting. It's about to pass the $500 million mark. And of course, it's a front runner to get a lot of Oscar nominations. I'm sure it will sweep in the tech categories.
That's true.
And number three is Escape Plan, another $16 million. And number four is Jackass Presents Bad Grandpa. I should say number four, five, and six all made about $14 million. Bad Grandpa made $14 million, and it passed the $100 million mark. This movie is having great legs for a dumbass reality movie. Like, the Jackass movies never had legs like this. I don't know what's going on, but this movie's doing really well for what it is. And, of course, it costs $15 million to make, so it's well into the black.
I can tell you exactly what's going on with that film. Unlike the Jackass movies where...
There's a story,
correct.
Yeah. And so what? It's a nominal story. It's not like people said, oh, my God, what a brilliant, entertaining film. It's basically just a goof.
Yes, but they actually had a great marketing campaign where they showed the trailer and people who would normally never see a Jackass film actually went to see it.
Yeah, yeah, it's proven really successful. Also made $14 million, Ender's Game. That's at $56 million worldwide. And just under $14 million is Captain Phillips, the Tom Hanks film. That's at $146 million worldwide. In North America, it's made $90 million. So this week, you know, after next weekend or so, it will pass the $100 million mark in North America. That will become Tom Hanks' 18th film to gross $100 million or more in the North American market. As far as I can tell, that's more than any other actor in history. I'm not counting his cameo in the Simpsons movie. These are all substantial lead roles, basically.
Okay.
Tom Cruise has 17 films that grossed more than $100 million in North America, though there are two of them are sort of questionable. I think Austin Powers and Goldmember, I think that's essentially a cameo.
Oh, is that why you were asking me about that last week?
Yes, and he has a rather modest role in Tropical Thunder. I think that's more about the Robert Downey Jr. supporting role helped that film. People talked about Tom Cruise in that movie, but I don't think that's his film. I don't think I would necessarily, but, you know, full credit, he was in it. So 16 to 17 films Tom Cruise has. Tom Hanks is going to hit number 18 any day now. That is, as far as I can tell, without adjusting for inflation, as Sperling would say, that is the record, the all-time record. No one has had more films make $100 million in North America than Tom Hanks.
Well, now, Tom Hanks is a movie star. Tom Cruise is a movie star.
Yes, they are.
And even movie stars whose careers have waned and waxed, or I guess waxed and waned, I don't know. But even movie stars that aren't necessarily popular anymore here in the United States, I'm thinking of Sylvester Stallone. I'm thinking of Arnold Schwarzenegger, who, of course, left the industry for 8 years to go run the state of California as its governor. Even movie stars like that, while they may not be popular here in the United States, and their film this past week, Escape Plan, made $810,000.
Well, the Expendables did fine. I mean,
well yes,
they're not washed up.
No, they're not washed up. But internationally, $15 million this past. So these movie stars, especially internationally, even the ones whose careers might be on the downward slope, they are still, there's this reason for movie stars.
Right. They've doubled their movie made, Escape Plan. They made $23 million in the U.S. so far. It's made $53 million overseas, and it's still going strong. So it's going to, probably triple what it made domestically overseas. So, of course, that will help the movie become perhaps commercially successful. I forget what the budget is on that film. But yeah, I mean, they've had The Expendables. They've had other movies. They're hardly, they're on their downward slope. Tom Hanks, of course, has another movie coming out at Christmas, Saving Mr. Banks, right?
Which premiered premiered here at the AFI Festival, and everybody loved it.
Well, that could, if the planets align, that could make $100 million. That's certainly an adult film. It'll be a little harder to get there, but why not? So at number seven is Free Birds. This is the animated film about turkeys going back in time to end the tradition of eating turkey on Thanksgiving. It made another $12 million. Right behind it is Las Vegas. About old guys going to Vegas for a bachelor party. It's The Hangover with old people.
That's right.
It made $11 million. Somebody had a great line. I think it was Box Office Profits. They said it's a movie about what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas because you're so old you can't remember what just happened in Vegas anyway.
That's good.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good. At number nine is that Italian film we were talking about, Sole a Catenelle. I apologize for whatever I've done to that title. It's doing terrifically well in Italy. Another $10 million is at $44 million in that one territory. That's a monster hit. I'm sure we'll be seeing that here in America sometime soon. Also at $10 million is Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2. Another $10 million. It's just about to hit $200 million worldwide. So, solid movie, not a huge success. We thought perhaps it would have done better given the delightfulness that was the original. And number 11, a German comedy. I'm afraid to say the name of this movie. Fuck you, Gotti. Parents, cover your kids' ears. Sorry about that. It's a German comedy. It seems to be set in college, I think. It's from the director of Turkish for Beginners, which was a TV series and a movie. This guy's also done other TV shows in German, and he's written a number of things. And now this is his second directorial effort. It made $9.5 million in Germany and I think one other territory. So it's off to a solid start for that ribald comedy. And number 12 is About Time, the Richard Curtis romantic film. $8 million it made. It's at $44 million worldwide. And number 13 is 12 Years a Slave. This expanded greatly in North America. It made $6.6 million. It's at $17 million and counting. What do you think about this, Sperling? I guess I'm torn between tying a movie success to award season and trying to make as much money as possible. Maybe I'm confused. I keep thinking they're expanding this movie too quickly, too early, and they're going to lose all their momentum before the awards get out and people will be sort of over it. But maybe they're making the most money they could right now. Maybe they're being smart. But it's on 1,400 screens. It seemed really quick to me. And, it's only November. So we've got December, January, February, March. Maybe they'll just keep coasting along, or maybe they're squandering their chance to...
You're saying they're peaking too early for award season, that you need to peak somewhere in January.
Right, but of course, what they really need is to make money, and maybe they're doing the smart thing to make the most money.
And I think they probably are in this case. Argo was released in October, and it still won Best Picture.
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. You can be released in January and win Best Picture. I'm more concerned about whether they're squandering their best chance to make the most money. Not talking about winning the Oscar. I'm talking more about, have they squandered their chance to use the awards that this movie is going to get in nominations? Are they squandering the chance to capitalize on the end of the year list, on all the Golden Globes
and here's
Oscar
why.
Nominations?
Here's why. Right now, that film, 12 Years a Slave, has gotten a tremendous amount of press because it was in Telluride. It was in Toronto. People
got
loved it.
Got great reviews, blah, blah, blah. Yeah,
yeah, and it was everywhere. It was in the media everywhere. So there is a very high awareness right now about this film. That's mm-hmm. when you want it in theaters. Now, the good news for them is that you're probably right that it's going to be on everybody's end of the year list. So once again, it will be in the media, bringing it back to people's attentions. And
maybe
and
they'll re-release it in January or February.
Exactly.
Wide again.
Right. Yeah. Once they have more, once the Academy Award nominations are released. So it has three chances to be in the minds, in potential audience members' minds. That's exactly what you want. I think they're doing the right thing here.
All right, well, we'll see what happens with this movie overall. I wonder if 12 Years a Slave counts as a blockbuster bet in the indie world. If you look at Steve McQueen, his first film cost pennies. His second one cost $6 million. This cost $20 million. And for a film of this type, for the companies that made it, it's a big gamble and a big blockbuster bet in a way, isn't it?
Yes,
so,
it is.
So, what counts as a blockbuster bet depends on the context of your company and your budget and what you have. if I go out to lunch, that's a blockbuster bet in my world because I don't have a lot of money right now. At number 14 is Turbo. It's slowing down a little bit. $5 million, $275 million worldwide.
All we need is $25 million more dollars.
And I eat a snail.
And
or befriend a snail, really, is what I should do. At number 15 is Planes. That's $219 million worldwide. And at number 16 is Carrie, the horror film remake, which has not done as well as perhaps they hoped. That's at $42 million worldwide. In indie release, we had a strong opening for Dallas Buyers, I should say expansion, for Dallas Buyers Club, the Matthew McConaughey film about AIDS. That opened on 35 screens now, and it's making $17,000 per screen. And The Book Thief, which is not a very good movie, but it opened up on 4 screens and made $27,000 per screen. No, you will not be hearing that about that film come awards time, trust me.
Well, now, do you think $17,000 per screen is good?
It's pretty good, yeah.
Okay, because that's what Thor made this last
right,
Thor.
Right. It's better if you're on 3,800 screens.
Well, no, that's what it made in IMAX. It made $17,000 per screen in IMAX.
Ah, I see. Very good. Yes, because it was rushed into IMAX and a number. There are other large formats, aren't there? It's not just IMAX. What are the others?
Well, there's, you know, what Cinemark has. I think it's called Cinemark XD. And there's all these, what they're now calling premium large format, because digital and digital technology allows the, you know, these projectors to actually hit larger screens and blow things up where you can have two projectors synchronized to one screen. So all of these theaters are creating their own version of IMAX.
Well, yes, there was, what's it called? The Ewok on Times Square, 42nd Street. They had some faux name for their fancy big screen. It's not an IMAX. It's just a big screen with good sound. And they wanted like an extra $6 to sit there. And I'm like, shouldn't all your screens have good picture and sound? You know, I felt totally ripped off when there was, I think it's called RPX. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
It's the RPX premium experience. It's all malarkey. I don't care if I'm in the smallest theater in that 20 multi-theater complex. It should be a good picture and good sound. And my seat should be comfortable and the movie should look good. So I'm not paying extra for that. Well, but I will pay extra perhaps to see Wolverine.
Ooh, okay, which Wolverine, though? Because let's face it, there has been, and I don't even consider this news, frankly, because how many Wolverine movies have there been? Like nine?
Two.
No, but I mean, Wolverine the character has been in X-Men, played by...
It's all by Hugh Jackman the whole time.
Yeah, played by Hugh Jackman. And, you know, so he's been in a number of movies, like 3 X-Men movies and now 2 Wolverine movies, maybe even a 4th X-Men movie. I don't know.
There's been 4 X-Men films.
Okay, and he's been in all of them?
He's been cameos in some of them. He was a cameo in X-Men First Class,
okay.
Essentially. But that's fine. No, yeah, he's a standard character.
You know what would be news?
X-Men 2, X-Men The Last Stand, X-Men First Class, X-Men Origins, Wolverine, and The Wolverine. There's going to be another Wolverine film because it made $400 million worldwide, $414 million. It's the second most successful X-Men film of all in that whole family of movies.
Right.
It's made more than all the other X-Men films except X-Men The Last Stand. So, you know, you make money, you keep the budget reasonable, they'll make Wolverines from now till doomsday.
Well, that's why I'm saying I don't think it's news that they're making. What would be news is if they weren't making another one.
Exactly. Here's a bizarre choice, though. The Hunger Games is coming out, the sequel, which could build on the original. I don't say it will make exactly what the Hunger Games made because they were introducing that story and those books to a worldwide audience. So just like with the Twilight films, it's very likely that the second Hunger Games film will jump up a level, just as the second Twilight film jumped up a level and found that big worldwide audience. So once they reach that second level with Twilight, all the rest of those movies made about that amount of money. That could very well happen with the Hunger Games, or could even build on the third film. Who knows? But certainly, I think they expect and hope to have the Hunger Games sequel make more money than the original worldwide. But here's a nutty thing. I mean, this is just ridiculous. A Hunger Games theme park.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do? You're going to set your teenagers loose in the theme park and they can go out and kill each other?
I don't know. Yeah, it's called paintball. But I mean, what a horrible idea. The Lionsgate people say they've been approached in 2 different countries about potential theme park opportunities, which gives you a sense of the cultural impact of this franchise. They were talking up the movie and the franchise to analysts during a conference call. We're excited about these opportunities and are pursuing them. To which I would say, why? Who wants a Hunger Games?
Well, because you know why? Because they knew, and they being Lionsgate, they knew that if they said this during an analyst call or an earnings call, that it would get press. And by getting press, once again, it builds awareness for the movie.
You're saying they're lying?
No, I'm not saying they're lying at all.
So somebody did approach them and say, we would like to build a theme park.
Yeah.
To which I say, why? I'm not wondering why he talked it up in the conference call.
Oh.
I'm wondering why someone would want to make a theme park around a Hunger Games. It's a stupid, terrible idea. It's a very thin idea. It's not like the richness of the Harry Potter world. There's not the depth and complexity. There's not a lot of different things to do at the Hunger Games park except kill each other.
Well, maybe
it's a terrible idea for a theme park. It's not even a ride.
Don't they call that like military school, military academy?
Yeah. Well, it's not even a ride, but there you go. I think it's a stupid idea. It would be bad for the franchise. They certainly shouldn't say yes. They should not agree to a theme park because a bad theme park poorly done with bad attendance is a loser and hurts the image of the franchise.
Well, do you think this next story is a good idea? And the story is about television, and it's about Leslie Moonves, our good buddy and friend from CBS Broadcasting Networks.
It's not my friend.
Well, I'm saying that
hasn't returned my calls in ages.
Yeah, it's the royal good friend, you know, the royal we. So I guess he was talking to Wall Street analysts on Wednesday, and he started to push for Live Plus 7. Now, what Live Plus 3 is the live viewing plus 3 days worth of time shifted viewing, which is what CBS and several networks get paid for now. They get paid.
Advertisers pay for the ratings of a TV show.
That's
right. They say what the ratings get. You promise a certain level of rating, and if you exceed that, they're happy because, hey, look, they got more viewers than they paid for. If you fall below it, they're unhappy, and you often make up for it by saying, we'll give you another 30-second spot somewhere down the road with another show or even this show. We do a make good. So what happened is we had the DVR. They didn't deal with this with the VHS and the VCR, but they've now dealt with it with the DVR. They said, oh, my God, all these people are watching shows later that night, the next day, the day after. We're losing all these viewers, you know, all these people that are watching the show, we're not getting credit for it. So the network said, hey, you've got to pay us for the people that watch the show within 3 days of its airing on their DVR. We can track it. We can tell you how many are doing it, and you need to pay us for it. And they went back and forth. Finally, the advertisers agreed to do it because I guess they're convinced
for 3 days. They said,
right,
we'll do 3 days.
Right. They're convinced that people are not fast forwarding through the commercials, or they can spot and see what the commercials are, even if they do fast forward them, because that's how they make commercials these days. And so now networks are saying, you know what? We really want you to pay for the people who watch the show for 7 days after it airs, Live Plus 7, because they're viewers. Why shouldn't we get credit for that? And now they're going back and forth with advertisers, trying to convince them to expand even further, you know, how much they pay for viewership and what constitutes a viewer. If they watch it 6 days later on their DVR, should that be counted as a viewer for the advertiser? The networks say yes. The advertisers say, let me think about it.
Well, Leslie Moonves is not the first television executive to say this and to want Live Plus 7 to be counted.
Of course, because they got more, even modest shows add a couple hundred thousand viewers or millions, 3, 4, 5 million people within that next week watch a lot of these shows.
Well, I mean, he gave the example, Leslie Moonves, that is, of Hostages. He says, look, it's mediocre at best, okay? Or it's considered mediocre at best.
The ratings for the live version.
Right. He says about 8 million viewers watch Hostages when it premieres.
No. You're confusing. Sorry. He said the pilot episode was viewed by 8 million people. He said, but when you look at how many people checked out that pilot episode.
Okay, you see, you're talking,
over a 30-day period, it more than 16 million people checked out that pilot. So that's a lot more viewers. He is not saying that happens every week, because trust me, they're not. The ratings have fallen. The show's a disaster. It doesn't matter. So,
okay,
but he's still saying that first episode, because that's a big difference. He's not talking about every episode. That first episode was watched by 16 million people, not 8 million. And, you know, fall TV shows especially get a lot of tune in. But hey, that's a double the number. And he says we should get credit for it.
Right. And, you know, I would have to say Live Plus 7, okay, fine. But Live Plus 30, there's no way that some of these ads...
He's not asking for Live Plus 30.
I understand that. Some of these ads are timely. They want to be...
No one's asking for Live Plus 30.
Let me ask you this. He brought up this guy, David Poltrak, who works for CBS, but he has said the same thing that many researchers have found, which is that 50 to 60% of the people watching on DVR don't fast forward through commercials.
I don't believe it.
And everybody says the same thing.
I know people have the habit from the old days. I know some of my family sometimes does, where they use the commercial break to walk away.
Right.
And they go into the kitchen and go in there. I'm like, well, but you can just watch you can pause it whenever you want. Like, what's your problem? Why would you let the commercial air? Why wouldn't you just press pause and walk away, whatever? But whatever. So, yeah, I guess there's some people who still do that old habit of using the break as a chance, rather than just saying, let's watch the show as quickly as possible and then do whatever I want later. there are some people, I guess, who are still in that habit, but I'd love to see real numbers. They tell me this. I'd love to see an actual analysis by some third-party person who isn't invested in the idea that people are watching ads, because that's where they make their money. So these are the last people I want to trust on this.
Well,
I'm not saying
they're
lying, but come on. They have every – look at him. He's saying Hasa just doubled its viewership over 30 days. He's talking about the pilot, which they spent millions of dollars promoting, and it's going to be the most watched episode. And it dropped in the ratings second week, third week, fourth week, fifth week. So he's picking the best possible episode with the best possible return, and he stretched it out to 30 days. Because that's where he was able to announce a much bigger number. If he'd done Live Plus 3 or Live Plus 7, it wouldn't have been as impressive.
Are you trying to say are you trying to say that a television executive is using statistics to better their own argument?
Exactly. So yeah. When TV people tell me that, oh no, viewers watch the commercials, I go, well, I'm sure you have some way of thinking that's true, but I'd like to see somebody else analyze that and tell me that for a fact. And let me know what the study is and see if it's actually true.
I know that you are very diligent about fast-forwarding through the commercials.
Well, who wouldn't be?
Well, as for myself, I'm usually busy answering or responding to email or going through my email, and sometimes I'll forget that I can fast-forward through the show. As a matter of fact, here's the thing. I would be willing to stake a claim here that people are paying more attention to the commercials because they're busy during the show on their second screen. Meanwhile...
What?
Wait, just follow me here. When they have to fast forward through a commercial, you have to look at the screen. You have to say, okay, there's one commercial for Bounty.
There's the AT&T ad with that guy who's on Sunday Night Live. Let's watch that.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, there's a trailer for Thor: The Dark World. Let's watch that.
Exactly.
It's possible, I guess. It's crazy. I tell you what, stop reading your emails while you're watching a show.
I'm sorry, hold on. I didn't hear you. I was reading an email. What did you say?
How old are your kids?
8 and 7.
Okay, so they're watching TV. They're old enough. They're watching TV.
No, they don't. They don't watch TV. They watch movies.
That you on DVD or something.
Yes, correct.
There's no television show. They don't watch SpongeBob. They don't watch anything.
Nope.
Why not? They go to school and kids say, "Oh, did you see The Adventures of Pete and Pete?" I can't think of a kids show that's hot right now. I don't know why. But oh, did you see blah 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 last night? And they're like, "No."
Yes, that's right. Because don't you know that television rots your brain?
Well, I was just saying, I would think with kids especially, you'd want to have a rule that if there is some actual television that they want to watch and you agree to, that you say, but no commercials. You tape it and they watch it the next day, or they watch it later that, you know, a half hour later and fast forward the commercials, because the rule is you don't watch commercials, because that's what I would want with my kids.
You know what?
And I know
they haven't
family
asked,
and friends who do that.
They haven't asked to watch a show. I'm not going to bring it up.
There's no TV they ever want to watch. God bless you. Are they reading books?
Yes, they are.
Well, all right. You've got the perfect children. I guess they're not watching soaps either.
No.
And a lot of people aren't. You know, there's only down to 4 soap operas left on television. And there was SoapNet, the Disney channel that used to broadcast soaps in prime time because they thought women went to work. Now they can't watch their soap during the day and it's hard to set your VCR. So back in 2000, they launched SoapNet, a cable channel devoted to rerunning that day's soap operas in prime time. You missed General Hospital at 3? We'll show it to you again at 8. Well, that channel, after 14, 13 years, is out of business.
Right, because people actually remembered that they had a VHS recorder or a DVR, and they could actually record those shows and didn't actually need an entire network to exist for that purpose.
Well, it made good money. In 2010 was its best year, which a little surprises me. It generated like over $100 million in cash flow, and it cost nothing to make because it was all reruns, and I think there was one show devoted to people chatting about that day's soaps. You know, so it cost pennies to put this show on the air. Reruns included like Ryan's Hope and Falcon's Crest, shows that were well off the air, never made any money in syndication. So they were, you know, had for pennies an hour, I'm sure. So it made money. It was a good move. It just has outlasted its time of both, you know, the DVR and soap operas in general. You know, we're just down to 4. General Hospital, The Young and the Restless, The Bold and the Beautiful, and Days of Our Lives. That's it.
You know what didn't make any money?
What?
Big Fish on Broadway.
Oh, you're spinning my head. Well, this is a new musical. It's based on the novel by John August, which was also turned into a film directed by Tim Burton.
Was it a novel or was it
It was a novel.
Okay.
It was a novel. And it was the Broadway production combined elements from the novel and the film to create a new Broadway musical starring Tony Winner, Norbert Leo Butz as Edward Bloom, a man who tells tall tales. He was played by Albert Finney in the film. His frustrated son who gets sick of his dad's tall tales and wishes he'd just tell the truth once in a while. That's played by Bobby Steggert.
And I'd like to correct you. It was John August wrote the screenplay. Daniel Wallace wrote the novel.
Daniel Wallace wrote the book, Big Fish. John August wrote the screenplay for the film. And I think the book for the show, didn't he? Didn't he work on the book?
Yes.
Yes. I apologize to Daniel Wallace. And Bobby Steggert plays his son. That was played by Ewan McGregor in the film. And the wife, the love of Norbert Leo Butz's life, was played by Kate Baldwin. So a lot of talented people. It was directed by Susan Stroman, who I think also did the choreography. So she's a big Broadway talent. A $14 million show. It opened just a few weeks ago, and it's closing, you know, 3 months after it opened. So this is the first big, you know, flop of the Broadway season. Other shows that have closed include A Time to Kill, the John Grisham novel that was turned into a Broadway drama. Not a good show also. First Date, also not a good show, starring the guy from, what's that spy show, that TV show?
Oh, that narrows it down. A spy show? A TV?
You
Homeland?
Know, the guy, the computer nerd who's turned into a spy.
Chuck.
Yes. That guy starred in the show. I couldn't remember what his name is.
Wasn't he also Entangled or something? No, was it Tangled?
Oh, here we go. Well, yeah, man, he did the voice in Tangled, didn't he? And also Soul Doctor, which was never, nobody had high hopes for that, or Let It Be, which was a limited run.
Was it Zachary Levi?
Yes.
Yeah.
Let It Be, which is a Beatlemania type show. That was set for a limited run, but it closed even earlier than they expected. So Big Fish really is the big one here. Time to Kill was a solid budget, but Big Fish was a big show, a lot of talented. It's a shame because Bobby Steggert and Kate Baldwin starred in a great musical called Giant, an adaptation of the novel and, of course, the film starring, you know, Rock Hudson, Elizabeth Taylor, and James Dean. That was turned into a musical that's played out of town. It played at the Public here in New York. It was sensational. And I wish to God they'd been able to come to Broadway with that show, because I'm not sure it would have been a huge commercial hit, but at least it was a good show.
Well, did you see Big Fish?
I did, yes.
And you didn't like it?
My review is on Huffington Post. No, I didn't like it at all.
Okay. And I know you saw Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark End. Again, didn't like it at all.
No.
And you've been tracking this now for I don't even know how many weeks where it's actually not making any money. It's not covering its weekly expenses, its weekly nut.
Right. We believe it costs about $1 million a week to run. It's the most expensive show on Broadway. And of course, it had the biggest budget ever, $75 million to put this on once the delays and the 6 months of previews were all accounted for. So this is a hugely expensive show. It costs $1 million to week. And for the past 12 weeks, about, it has been losing money every week. So it goes up, it goes down. Sometimes it loses $300,000, sometimes just $40,000 or $50,000. But it's been consistently losing money and it was barely breaking even for months before that. So this show is on its last legs. It's going to close. It's lost about $2 million in the last 3 months. And, you know, it only had made about $5.8 million for the entire year in profit. So now that's already dropped down to $3.8 million. And every week they stay open, it's getting lower and lower. So, you know, eventually they're just going to be going farther and farther into the red. It's never going to make back its money unless some miracle happens on the road, which they haven't even bothered to do yet. You know, this show will never make it. So, of course, any week now, any day now, I think once the fall is over, I think they're going to announce that Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark is closing. And when they do, everyone will say, what a disaster, what a flop, what a horror it is. And I think that's overstating it. I mean, Big Fish is a flop. This show cost $14 million to make. It opened and closed basically right away. You know, a few weeks later after it opened and closed. Audience didn't like it. Critics didn't like it. Nobody liked it. Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark certainly didn't get good reviews. It was doomed to financial failure because it cost too much money to make. If you make a movie for $1.2 billion, chances are you're not going to make a profit, right? It's just not possible. But to its credit, Spider-Man has been on Broadway for 3 years. 3 years.
And how many films have done that in the past?
No, you mean Broadway shows?
Yes, sorry.
Very few Broadway shows, less than 100. It did not begin its official opening until 6 months into its run because of all the horror stories it had. But even accounting for that, now that it's officially open, you start counting the episodes, or you start counting the performances, it has now passed 1,001 performances.
And how many shows have done that?
108 shows in all of Broadway history have run for 1,000 or more performances.
I knew that I could ask you, and you have the answer at the tip of your fingers there. And not only are you like, oh, I don't know, about 105, like you're like 108.
Right. Well, I looked it up, of course, before the show. So 108 shows in all of history have played on Broadway as long as Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. So yes, it was doomed to failure. Yes, it's a financial flop. It was doomed from the start. It's not a success. But let's not overstate the fact that, yes, they were right. There was an audience for the show. They came out to see it for 2 years. It did really well. Now the last year, it's been fading out. But that's very few shows in history ever get to run this long. So yeah, it didn't work at all. doomed to failure, but not a flop in the sense of like Big Fish or a lot of other shows that open and close in a week. So yeah, doomed. But let's not go overstate the fact that this was some sort of horrible, idiotic idea. They made this puppy run for 3 years, and that's kind of amazing.
Well, when they, you know, produced the show for $75 million, as you know, or as you mentioned, I just stepped on my own joke there. But I was going to say something about isn't it ironic that it should not make money? Because, of course, we have another story here about Alanis Morissette bringing her Jagged Little Pill album from 1995, I believe. Or 94 to Broadway, because that
well,
just
no, not to Broadway. They're doing a workshop production of it. It's okay. Very, very early. Of course, ultimately, any stage musical or thing you create, the goal is to take it to Broadway. That goes without saying, I guess, or to West
hey,
End
hey,
of London.
Who are you talking to? I watched Smash. Okay.
So yeah, of course, that's the ultimate goal. But they're not taking it to Broadway yet. It's just a workshop production. But she's, you know, going to use all the songs from the album, which came out in 95, I believe, and sold, you know, a gazillion copies. It came out in 1995. They're going to use all the songs from that album, plus some other songs from other albums and some new songs that she hasn't recorded or new songs that she's going to write. And they're going to create a show. They're going to see if it can turn it out into a musical. Obviously, the idea, I guess, is like Green Day's American Idiot, though Jagged Little Pill is not a concept album. It does not tell a straightforward story like that one does. But it sold 33 million copies, so people are pretty familiar with the album. And she's working with Tom Kitt, who did work on American Idiot and the Pulitzer Prize winner Next to Normal. So he's used to unusual projects. And they're going to put it up, workshop it, and see what they got. I think right now it's kind of a big whoop because they're just doing a workshop production. If it's a success and moves to Broadway, then it'll be a big deal.
Ah, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about Star Wars, because, you know, how can we have one of these segments without Star Wars being mentioned? Not only did Disney refuse to push back the opening of the next Star Wars movie, they've even announced a release date to up the pressure on filmmaker J.J. Abrams and writer Lawrence Kasdan. Mind you, they did choose December 18th, 2015, so it's just about the last date they could choose in 2015. But still, that must have been a fun call to make, don't you think? I mean, I'm sure the artiste Abrams enjoys getting a slap on the wrist and a firm deadline as much as anybody else. Maybe they should have chosen Terrence Malick to direct instead of all these dilly-dalliers. He has not one, not even two, but three movies coming out in 2014 alone.
That's ridiculous.
I mean, the guy didn't make a movie for 25 years. Now he's making three per year. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a big stupid deal. They're looking at Marvel's The Avengers and saying, we've got to do this. We've got this big plan. Stick to the program. I could understand their firmness if they were in the middle of their schedule. But since this is the first film to launch the whole planned Star Wars trilogy, Star Wars spinoffs, 5 years in a row, don't you want to start it off right? For the love of God. Just don't you think this is crazy?
Well, you know, I guess J.J. Abrams was doing some press for Almost Human, I think is the name of the show that he's producing.
That's right. And about a robot cop.
And he was, which actually looks quite good. I was reading, I guess he was asked that, you know, why did Michael Arndt step down as the writer? And he said, we had to, if we wanted to get this done on the schedule that we needed to get it done on, both myself and Larry needed to come in and take over. It had nothing to do with Michael's story or his, you know, performance as a writer, if you will. But more, we just needed to cut out the middleman.
I like this. In the Hollywood Reporter, talk about soft-soaping Michael Arndt. Somebody wanted to make nice to him because the quote was that, well, he'd already worked on it for a while, worked on it a year, done this treatment for the whole trilogy, blah, blah, blah. But as one of Hollywood's highest paid screenwriters who can command more than $300,000 a week doing rewrites, the Oscar-winning scribe was ready to move on to other projects. Yes, that's right. He was eager to move on to other projects. He didn't want the most, you know, storied project of his career. No. He was eager to get going and leave and drop this behind.
Call my agent and tell them to get me on a bigger film.
Yes, yeah, somebody was making nice to Michael Arndt. So I think it's a big deal. I don't get it, but we'll see what happens.
Well, this next story is kind of interesting. And it's interesting because, well,
do we have violin music playing in the background?
Exactly, or taps, I don't know. Because this year marks the end of celluloid for wide releases in North America. It's all digital from here on out. We've talked about that in the past. And it's also the end of another iconic movie fixture, Blockbuster Video. The chain launched in 1985 and which had 9,000 outlets at its peak is no more. They were purchased by Dish Networks for about $320 million in 2011. And now the final 300 stores, they're closing up shop. Their online attempt to mimic Netflix is also kaput. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop at this point. I mean, you know, what's the point? Dish, I don't know why Dish bought them. I'm sure we questioned it at the time.
Maybe
you can look back at the episode and show we're not making that up. We're not second-guessing ourselves the way Hollywood is with 3D. They said they were going to sell devices to stream blockbuster movies via the stores, but ran into snags. Is it a land deal? Do they have rights to any of the land? Did the stores own any of the land they were on? That's the only reason I can see why they might not lose their shirt. They have the right to the blockbuster brand name, but who cares about that at this point?
Yeah, it was never a smart move. We said so at the time.
Though if they own the land, it could be, not that Dish Network is in the land business, but if they have the land and they can sell that off, they can make their money back perhaps. Maybe that's where it comes in. But a lot of those are rentals, I assume.
Yes, they are. And I think when I heard this the other day, I think I sent out a tweet that said, wait, you mean they haven't closed all the Blockbuster stores already?
Well, exactly.
And I'm just glad because I owe so many late fees to Blockbuster. Now they'll never be able to collect. It's the end of an era, as we just mentioned, for Blockbuster, but it's also the end of an era as DC ends its 8 decades in New York City and is moving all of its operations out to California, out by me, so that all the divisions of the publishing house / movie franchise can be under one roof. DC Entertainment President Diane Nelson spoke to the Wall Street Journal and emphasized again and again how this was not the tail wagging the dog, how the movie and TV properties being developed by Warner Brothers were not so important that the publishing side, you know, the comic books that create all those franchises, that they had to follow the money out to California. It was creatively stifling to not have everyone under one roof. And it's sad, but they won't miss out on anything on the publishing side by moving 3,000 miles away. Also, the weather is better in L.A. from what she hears. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I'm cold right now. It's a high of 50 degrees, so the weather is better out there. What's the weather in L.A.?
I think yesterday was 85 degrees. I could be wrong.
I hate you. This is ridiculous. You know, creating comic books and creating movies and TV show spinoffs with Batman and Superman and all the other people, those are very different jobs. And there's no creative synergy of having the people who choose and create and publish the comic books next door to the people. And it's New York and LA. You can't talk to each other. You can't fly out. You can't telecommunicate. You know, she said, we tried to have an office costume party and we had people on Skype and it just wasn't the same. what the hell? You know, but I think it's very bad. They're losing their presence in New York. They're losing their link to comic book people and losing their link to that history that they have. And I just don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it helps at all. I think it diminishes the comic books, which is where all your ideas come from.
Well, I think Gotham City in the next Batman film will have palm trees. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, artists have been using Kickstarter to fund their various projects in movies, music, theater, books, and so on for a while now, for quite some time. But graphic novel publisher Fantagraphics is taking the idea one step further. After the death of one of their founders exacerbated a cash flow problem that the company had, they have launched a Kickstarter campaign to fund its entire spring 2014 list of 39 books which are going to be published. They specialize in graphic novels and reprints of classic comic strips, overseas artists, and other graphic-related items. They're hoping to raise $150,000, which seems like a lot, but after 2 days, they hit $100,000. Among the titles are new releases and new packaging of titles by Daniel Clovis, Joe Seiko, and Gilbert Hernandez. In contrast, the cheeky indie publisher McSweeney's has set a crowdfunding goal of, get this, $15. Yes, $15. They've already matched their goal, or to be exact, reached 65,000% of the goal, and that's astonishing. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, McSweeney's is funny. That's clever. They have lots of giveaways for people who donate money at certain levels. Their joke was always to raise more than $15, and they're independent, so they need money too. But I thought that was a clever way to get attention.
A great way to get attention for this campaign. They're obviously raising money to keep the publishing house going, right?
Right, exactly.
And all these Kickstarter campaigns, they're a dime a dozen now. You need to do something special. They did it at $15. They got a ton of press.
Yeah. Fantagraphics, and McSweeney's is a great publisher. They do cool stuff. I love Fantagraphics. I love the stuff that they do. I try to support them as much as possible. They've now been up for 7 days, and they've reached $141,000. So they've got 23 days to go to get the extra $9,000, so they'll almost certainly make it. 2,090 people have donated money, at least $1, to this program. So that's cool for them. I think it's a big deal. Every business, are they charities? You know, but people love comic books. They love graphic novels. I'm not giving them money, but I am giving them a little press and attention in various ways on Huffington Post and here to try and send people to them. So people who support what they do and like it, chip in $10 and they'll be able to get more of the rare and beautiful collections that those people create.
Well, now, I know you're going to love this next story, Michael. Simon Cowell is returning to American Idol. I was hoping that the next words would be the United Kingdom, but no, it's American Idol. You heard it here first. The X Factor has collapsed on Fox. It's down, you know, a modest 30 to 40% from last year. Given the given the expense of the show, the young demos it pulls may not be able to save it. Certainly one more season is all they can expect, barring a miracle. 2 weeks ago, it ranked, number 80. Yeah, number 80 for one of its broadcasts. That's not good. This week, in the key 18 to 49 demo that should be its strength, it tied for third with the CW's Aging Vampire Diaries, to which I say, if you're tying with the CW, your show is off the air. Only ABC's mega flop, Once Upon a Time, spinoff was lower. Given all of this, and given all of that, The X Factor won't be on the air in 2015, if that. And with Simon Cowell free and Idol looking to boost attention, it seems inevitable that they'll get back together. If they're really smart, they'll even bring back the classic, quote-unquote, lineup of Simon, Randy, and Paula. That would be amazing. For a final season as well. Could they actually advertise it and market it as bringing the band back together? Would that be allowed? Okay. Well, is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. The X Factor was a big bet for Fox. It's not worked at all, and it's really collapsed. The Voice is winning in every possible way. It's crushed it. It's crushing it right now. It blows my mind because the talent he gets is so much better. The Voice has nothing talent-wise, but it has an entertaining show and people like it.
Doesn't American it have CeeLo Green petting a cat or something like that?
I don't think he pets a cat too much, but okay. Yes. Seth Green? You mean Seth what? You mean CeeLo Green?
CeeLo Green. Oh, didn't I say? What did I say?
I Seth Green? You said Seth Green, yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Very, very different people. If you see them together, you can see that they're probably not related. But yeah, the talent on The X Factor is great. Last year, they launched this girl group, Fifth Harmony. They're in the top 10 all over the world. This season, they got a lot of really commercial acts. This country boy band, Restless Road, Sweet Suspense, another girl group, and a couple artists. I mean, they're doing their job. They're finding real talent that is turning out hit records, which is something that The Voice has never come close to doing.
So what you're saying is that the people watching this show, The X Factor, is you.
Apparently.
Yeah.
But it is working. They are finding talent. And they are launching careers, which is something The Voice has never done. But I think it's inevitable. Obviously, nobody's been saying anything. It may not be back next year, which means Simon Cowell may be available for the 2015 winter edition of American Idol. He obviously won't be available this winter, come January. So 2015, he'll be available. I don't see why they wouldn't do it. I don't see why he wouldn't do it. You know, it works well for everybody. I predict it will absolutely happen because there's money to be made.
Now, I knew when I heard this story and read about this story during the week, I said, wow, Michael is totally going to put this in big deal, big whoop. And sure enough, here's this story. Amazon has asked independent bookstores to slit their own throats this week and even offered to send them the knife to do it with.
What?
I thought the same thing when I heard the story. I was like, why would any independent bookstore do this? Okay, well, it's not exactly what Amazon offered. They didn't really offer them, slit your own throats. But they kind of did. What they really said was, hey, guys, why not sell our Kindles to your customers? For the first 2 years, you'll get 10% commission on all ebook sales. Even better was offering 35%. This is what Amazon was offering, 35% off Kindle-related merchandise like covers and all that kind of stuff. Oddly, independent bookstores seem lukewarm about getting their customers hooked on the defining product of their biggest competitor, Amazon. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop because everybody is turning up their nose at it.
Yeah.
They're saying, what the heck? Are you out of your mind? However, in the UK, Waterstones took them up on this deal. They did not have the wherewithal to create their own device. They didn't think they could compete with Amazon or other people. And they said, our customers are going to buy ebooks. we might as well make some money off it. And they launched them a few years ago. It's not clear to me whether there's a sell-off date where they stop getting a commission on their customers that they send to Amazon the way they've agreed to these people. You get 2 years and then you're done. I'm not sure if Waterstones got better deal than that or what they negotiated with Amazon, but they've done it. We don't have good figures, but everybody thought they were crazy and they continue to do it. And here's the place where they're going to have a play. It is not the independent mom and pop bookstores. It's not going to be the ones with big loyal followers like Powell's or others. It's going to be college bookstores. College bookstores are independent bookstores. Why would they sell the Kindle? Their customers aren't there after 2 years.
That's true.
They've only got them for 4 years at the most. If they can make 2 years of money off the ebooks that college students buy, it's a win-win. So, hey, Amazon's going to put their Kindle in a bunch of college bookstores if they haven't already. I'll give them a more incentive to sell them to the college students, and they lock in those students right away. So that's a smart move.
If these singing shows like The X Factor aren't going to do well, and those types of reality shows aren't going to do well anymore, then boy, do I have a show for you. Because it's only a matter of time before there's a reality show set in the space station or on the moon. That's almost a given. You know, it's just a matter of technology and getting the crew up there and figuring out how to set up the craft service table and all that. But in fact, the Mars mission recruiting people who want a one-way trip to the Red Planet is designed to be a media cash cow with training and the flight and survival on Mars all presented to TV in order to raise funds for the project. So no one is surprised at all that Richard Branson's space venture has a TV deal. NBC is going to follow preparations for the Virgin Galactic spaceship, which is Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2, which is kind of a rocket plane.
And right, they go up into suborbital. So they go up above the Earth, you get a little weightlessness, and then you come back down. You don't actually go to the moon or go into space station level. You just go up and you come back down. But you do get weightlessness, and it's really cool.
Yeah, it's kind of what Alan Shepard did in 1963, I think. I don't know. And when it launches with Branson and his two children and three other passengers next August, which is when this is going to happen, Branson's going to be on board. NBC will cover this suborbital flight live. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. I mean, really, you know, it's a TV tie-in to his space initiative. It's a one-time show, whatever. It's a big whoop. However, a lot of famous people have signed up to pay the $250,000 to be on a flight if and when this happens. And I can imagine that NBC saying, hey, Richard, for that first flight that we're going to air nationally, why not let Leonardo DiCaprio come along? Why not let Stephen Hawking come along? Because they both booked tickets. They both want to do it. I'm pretty sure NBC is saying, you know, it'd be really cool if they were on that first flight.
They're trying to put movie stars into their TV show. That's
of course.
Exactly. Well,
and DiCaprio would be like, you want to make a TV special with me? Wait a second. Oh, I want some money.
You know what? Call me when you can get me from LA to London in 40 minutes, which is what the plan is eventually. But
oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
What happens in New York to London? You like go back in time?
I have no idea. Oh, that would be a really good idea. Somebody get me Steven Spielberg on the line. See, that was a Back to the Future joke there.
Oh, you could have said Robert Zemeckis.
Yeah, but I kind of forgot his name when I was in the midst of the joke. So you're okay. Right. Would have been much better.
Eric Stoltz, you're fired again.
Exactly. Don't worry, this footage will never see the light of day in the 1980s. In the 2000s, it'll be put on YouTube. In any case, and by the way, that's a really inside joke because you really have to know what we're talking about.
Keep going.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, you have to know Eric Stoltz was in Back to the Future.
Inside baseball.
Yeah, you see that? You know, and then they fired Eric Stoltz and hired Michael J. Fox. It's all inside baseball. So it must be time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, we're going to do a very quick kind of...
I told you.
Exactly. Michael didn't want to do this story at all. And I said, look, you know, when we did this story the last time, it was probably going to happen because Nikki Fink, who started Deadline Hollywood and then sold it to Jay Penske and Penske Media, she was kind of bad-mouthing Jay Penske and Deadline, and Deadline was saying, well, we'd love to have you stick around, but, you know, you don't seem to want to. But now it's official. She has left. Deadline has said she's no longer there. She's no longer writing stories there. She has redirected NikkiFink.com away from Deadline and to her own holding page, her own landing page. And she is giving interviews to the press and she's saying, look, you know, her catchphrase, told ya, as Michael just mentioned, you know, she always used to say that when something that she had predicted actually happened. Apparently Jay Penske trademarked it, so she might have to come up with another something else, you know.
So her page now, NikkiFink.com, just says, come for the cynicism, stay for the subversion, don't steal Nikki's scoops. And her tip line is open, so if you want to tell what mid-level executive is leaving their job, you can let Nikki Fink know right away. That's open right now. And she's got a little drop of blood dripping from the top of the screen. So she's ready. She's ready to go. She just needs contract approval.
That's
I guess
right.
She needs to go to the courts to clear this all up, right?
Well, I guess, yeah, that's the other bit. She says, look, I don't have a non-compete clause in my contract. And you know,
they say, yes, you do.
And they're saying, well, no, you can't actually write for a competitor until your contract is over. And that's 2016. So you're kind of sidelined until 2016. So we'll see what happens there. But that's pretty much the end of that story. Is it's now official. It's now done. If she ever starts something up again, maybe we'll talk about it then. I hope not. What people are really talking about, though, is how Marvel and Netflix are teaming up.
That's right. You know, Netflix has been moving into programming. Marvel, obviously, is a massive success on comic books and film and publishing and toys and games and merchandise. They launched their show on ABC, The Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Marvel's The Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It's not doing great, but it's got such young viewers. It's doing okay, but it's certainly not been the big success that ABC hoped for. But it's doing pretty good. It's good counter-programming. It gets young viewers. And it's doing all right. You know, we'll have to see where it is by the end of the season, but it's certainly not building on the massive launch that it had. You know, it launched very well. It got sampled. It's fallen quite a bit. Now it seems to have stabilized, so it's not in danger of being canceled anytime soon. But it's not been an out-and-out hit. Nonetheless, Marvel coming to network television again after many years off. Of course, they had Spider-Man in the 70s, which I watched that show, and some others. And they had Spider-Man animated cartoons and other stuff. So Marvel is always a player in television, but that was a big step back in, especially after the big, big success of the movies. Now, they're skipping network TV completely, aren't they?
Well, yeah, and what's interesting is that Marvel is owned by Disney, and this Shields, the Shields
is on Disney's ABC.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is on Disney's ABC, so you would think that they would have said, hey, let's go to ABC first. So I'm wondering if ABC passed on this. I mean, these are characters, the shows they brought to Netflix, these are characters that aren't necessarily very popular. Daredevil, Jessica Jones.
Well, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is not well known either. That's not, you know.
True.
They're using their second-tier characters for TV shows because they're saving, of course, Iron Man and Thor and the Incredible Hulk. Well, the Incredible Hulk, is that not Marvel? No. Yeah, it is Marvel.
Yes.
The Incredible Hulk for, you know, something else. And that was actually quite a good TV show. But yeah, so I don't know what came first, the choice of the characters because they were going to Netflix, or the choice of Netflix and they decided but basically what they're doing is recreating that great campaign they did in movies. They're going to recreate that on Netflix. In the movies, they launched Iron Man and relaunched The Incredible Hulk and launched Thor and Captain America and led up to The Avengers. Now on Netflix, they're going to launch four different TV series, four characters, each with 13 episodes. You're going to have Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Iron Fist, and Luke Cage. And notice there you've got a blind guy. Is it Luke Cage black?
I believe he is, yes.
Right, and Jessica Jones is a woman. So you got a great demographic mix there.
And then you got a guy who's metal, Iron Fist.
Right, people love metal. So you got four characters. They each get 13-episode series, and then they all come together in a mini-series called The Defenders. It's literally the same blueprint that they did in movies, and they're going to do it not on TV, but on Netflix.
Well, and Netflix, if I'm not mistaken, didn't Netflix strike a deal with, was it Netflix or Amazon that they struck that deal with?
It was Netflix that they brought Disney programming to Netflix last year in 2012. So that had been a big get for them. They wanted kids programming. Disney has a lot of valuable kids programming, some very successful cable channels like Disney Junior. And they did finally bring Disney, you know, episodes of different shows to Netflix back in 2012. So obviously that's worked out, or they have a good working relationship. Clearly ABC and Disney, everybody signed off on this. But it's fascinating they would take it to Netflix, isn't it? Though it would be hard to do on a regular network. I mean, how would you do it? If you were going to do all these four characters, would you have one in the fall, one in the spring, then another one the next fall, another one the next spring, and then climax with the miniseries? Or, you know, it would take like 2.5 years or something, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good... Yeah, I don't know how they plan to do it. That's a good question.
I mean, they could do them all at once, and you know, who knows? Who knows what their plan will be? But the possibilities are endless. It's kind of intriguing, and it certainly shows the power of Netflix and the fact that they have deep pockets, and whatever the numbers are for, you know, House of Cards and Arrested Development, they're doubling down on original programming.
Yeah, and I guess it was right at the end of last year that, as I mentioned, Disney cut this deal with Netflix for to bring their movies during the pay TV window, which was kind of, you know, they're basically foregoing HBO in that regard, or Epix, or any one of these.
Well, they just went to another buyer.
Right, precisely.
Not that they're foregoing somebody. You chose in the old days between HBO and Showtime. Now you're choosing between HBO and Showtime and Netflix.
But I wonder if part of that was, look, well, you know, we'll give you this and you know, basically Disney was saying, but we want original programming. So if we take that at such and such a price, you have to give us some original programming. And this is what they decided on.
I doubt the deal was made last year. I doubt that they, you know, quid pro quoed back in 2012 to make this announcement today.
No, but deals like this, they always, you need to know somebody. And they obviously Netflix.
Well, they're in business together, right?
That's right. That's what I mean. Precisely. But, you know, you and I are in business together here on the show.
Business meaning a nonprofit.
Oh, well, yes, it is a nonprofit. That is true. But in fact, you can donate to the show. If you go to showbizsandbox.com, there's a little donate button and you can donate through PayPal.
Hey, that's a nice new car you have in front of your house.
Yeah.
People been donating money all this time?
No, I wish. but as I mentioned,
well, Sperling, that's a lovely Rolex watch you have. Oh, thanks, Michael. I'm hungry.
Well, as I mentioned at the head of the show, you can subscribe to Showbiz Sandbox on iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher or wherever you happen to download podcasts. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. And that's where you'll find all those ways to contact us and follow us. Again, we're on Twitter. Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. We're on Facebook, where you can search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up, which you can like. You can also call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Or you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. And let's see, tonight, this week, they are in St. Louis, Missouri, Madison, Wisconsin, Columbus, Ohio, and Indianapolis, Indiana. So go out and see them. Michael, you have a website. What is it this week?
Asgard.com. That's the home of Thor.
Ah, okay. Well, some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.